Welcome to Main Street on this Wednesday. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, we'll check in with our good friend Tom Ezern and another one of his Plainsfolk essays. And since it's Wednesday, it's also time for Prairie Plates and our friend Rick Guillon. Rick and I will talk about the many fall options there are for great food in the region. But we start today with our philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota. We talk once a month about various topics, and today's topic is about sport and politics. How do they mix, and does treating politics as sport devalue it? It's my pleasure to welcome back to Main Street our philosophical currents man, and that's Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a philosophy instructor, professor at the University of North Dakota. Dr. Weinstein, it's a pleasure to visit with you again.
Oh, it's always wonderful to be here.
Before we start, we have this. This is a regular feature for Main Street, right? Philosophical currents. And all of our other folks who have a regular feature have their own walk-up music, so to speak, Jack. So if you were to have walk-up music that we would play before we do this, what would it be?
I have always joked that... This will reveal the 90s guy in me, that it's what a man, what a man, what a man, what a mighty fine man, because there's a great line, a body like Arnold and a Denzel face.
My man is smooth like Barry and his voice got bass. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep.
That's on, you know, how could that be more Jack?
We will work on that for next month's philosophical currents. But walk-up music is like sport and sports, right, Jack? People have their walk-up music when they come to the plate, when they're announced in basketball. And our topic today is, does the term sport of politics undermine then the importance of politics, Jack? And what made you think of that question?
You know, I was very interested in the spectacle of the convention and how much not just the process caught people's eye, but also the guests and the, you know, the balloons and all of that sort of thing. And there is a part of me, the sort of the philosopher with one foot perpetually in classical Greece, that makes me think this is a little unseemly. There is a kind of dignity to a democracy. There is a kind of honor in being a citizen. And at its best, a convention can bring that out. But at its worst, it becomes a political circus. And I was really wondering, to what extent does this undermine that sense of dignity, purpose, and honor to have guys who are playing drums while upside down or what have you?
An election at its very core is a competition. Might you be able to think that defining it as a sport or a competition may in fact enhance public interest and therefore make a more informed electorate?
Well, I think that's right. Because again, with that foot in classical Greece, there was a real attitude, both in Greece and in Rome, that being a citizen was the highest type of person, that it was the most noble, the best thing that you can be. This became problematic because women were not allowed to be citizens, and slaves obviously were not, but in and of itself as a description of humanity, that being a citizen was the thing that we should strive for. In the United States, we don't really hold to that anymore. We have to persuade people to be citizens. We have to persuade people to have a kind of community-mindedness, whether it's from the not in my backyard kind of people to the I hate to pay taxes kind of people to I'm not going to help raise your kid people. There is always, there's always ever present this undercurrent of resistance. And since the last number I heard is 50%, you may have a different number, but since about 50% of people don't vote, there has to be some way to get folks to care enough, to get excited enough, to be enthusiastic enough to vote, let alone to donate to the candidate. So absolutely, I think that this is essential in terms of motivating, but I think that the roots of the motivation or the lack thereof run very, very deep in our political tradition.
I think the Secretary of State's office in this state would be thrilled, Jack, if 50% of the people voted. And that has been a surprise to me, at least in the elections that I've seen so far. This will be the first presidential election that I've been able to participate in as a North Dakotan. But I've been surprised at really the lack of enthusiasm for any of the electoral questions that have been presented since I've been here.
And that becomes super extreme when you're involved in local elections. I mean, I don't know what it's like in the smallest of towns where there are a few hundred people and there's a very different sentiment. But in Grand Forks, in Fargo, if it's a summer election or if it's a non-presidential year or something like that, the numbers drop even more. And what's surprising to me is that people don't understand that in that instance, 2 votes, 4 votes, 8 votes, they really do make a difference. It may not be the case that in most presidential or even gubernatorial elections that a small handful of people could win the day, but in Grand Forks, let alone Rugby, a small handful of people could absolutely win the day. And so then why aren't people vying to be that small handful of people? Right. Again, let's look at the sports metaphor for a second. You know, if your team really has a shot to go to the World Series, you're going to work extra hard. And so if your team has the opportunity to push the citizen referendum or get your person on the city council
or mayor's race or whatever,
yeah, sure. Why doesn't that make you more enthusiastic rather than less enthusiastic? And so there is something about the political game that is in opposition to the sports game, because the more likely you are to win in politics, the less enthusiastic you are. And that's just kind of weird.
The tax questions that have been presented and the lack of enthusiasm to really show up and vote one way or another maybe doesn't have the sports metaphor that we're talking about today, but still, I think it's really real, right? You still have people who really believe in a project, a new school perhaps, or infrastructure for a community, and you have others that don't. We haven't had that enthusiasm about those elections that I've seen here, at least in this state, when it impacts your pocketbook, right?
That's absolutely right.
You have to pay.
When we ask about the sport of politics, I think we can ask a bunch of different questions that go down different, you know, avenues of discussion. We can ask about the spectacle of politics, right? The images, the symbolism, the photo ops, the insults and all of that kind of thing, right? The things that are designed to enhance the entertainment value of politics. We can also talk about the competition element of politics, where what it is mano a mano, right? That you have to face someone on their own terms, and you want to try to get them to face you on your terms. You and I were having a conversation earlier off the air about Donald Trump being in a defensive posture rather than an offensive posture, and how that makes this election very different than the last election. There's that boxing sense again. If you are up against the ropes, the idea that you can come out swinging and prevail is, it's much harder to believe. It's much harder to have faith in. So that there is that element of the person against person competitive element. But then there's also this collective identity about sports. I am not a huge sports fan. And one of the things that has always puzzled me the most is what I always call the sports we. And the sports we is, you know, you watch a game, your team does really well, and all your friends stand up and say, "We won, we won, we won." And my response is, "You didn't win. You sat on the couch, ate buffalo wings, and these unbelievable athletes woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning to lift weights and run so that they could, you know, engage in this very particular kind of human excellence." But we identify with the teams. We see ourselves as teams that, you know, there's all the stories that have a certain element of truth in them, that that instances of domestic violence go down when the local team wins and go up when the local team loses. The level of personal identification for an audience and a team, or fans and their teams, is awe-inspiring in the literal sense of the term. Donald Trump has been able to exploit that in the past. Donald Trump has been able to get his followers to really identify him with him the way that Yankees fans identify with the Yankees. I don't know that the Democrats have been able to do that. And I think that that's part of what their message of joy is trying to do. Tim Walz as a candidate, Coach Walz, and the ultimate upper Midwestern dad, right? There's a video of him going around now where, you know, someone asks him, you know, what's your hot take? And his answer is that the most neglected part of the house is the gutters. And then he gives a little lesson on how to, you know, how to clean your gutters and how to judge other people for not having clean gutters. And so once you have someone in that father role, you're starting to identify. But familial relationships are different than sports relationships. And so the question is, can the Democrats reclaim that level of group identity that is required to overcome the really, really intimate connection that Trump and his supporters have?
What I've wondered, Jack, after contemplating this question, really, if you go way back in history, and you know a lot more about political movements historically from a political philosophy standpoint than I do, really, isn't it always been like a sport? We're competing. I am trying to beat you because I feel I can do a better job perhaps than you, or I want this because of X. Hasn't it always been this way?
I actually don't think so. I think that there was a shift in and around the 18th century that it became a sport and ceased to be war. War is a more apt metaphor because people were really, you know, people were killing each other literally. And the stakes were not just who's going to govern and who makes decisions, but who's going to survive and whose children are going to rule and whether the land stays in the family and things like that. So you get this period of political sport in Greece and Rome, and then you get the church intrigue, and you get this notion that all of the politicking is behind the scenes. That's, by the way, where devil's advocate, the phrase devil's advocate, comes from. Traditionally, when they're going to decide on a pope, they make their decision, they get the person who they're going to select, they gather in the Sistine Chapel, and then someone is declared the devil's advocate. And that is the person who represents the criticism of the pope, the criticism of the candidate. And they are supposed to tell, speak like with devil's tongue, they're supposed to say absolutely everything bad they can think of the papal candidate. And if that pope can survive that tongue lashing, so to speak, then they become the pope, and then the smoke changes in the Sistine Chapel and they announce who the pope is. That's not sport. That's something dirtier. That's something uglier. That's something really in the darkness of humanity. And that's why devil's advocate is such an excellent name.
We are enjoying our conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Frist Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life at the University of North Dakota. Jack, ethically, does it change a candidate's mind if they are, in fact, treating this like an athletic event, like a sport, in, I'm going to win, I'm going to beat you?
You know, I've always struggled with this, too, because as much as there are certain politicians I admire, you do have to be a certain kind of narcissist to get at this level of politics, right? Yeah. You have to be comfortable with everyone watching you all the time. You have to be comfortable with all of the smallest words, you know, or the slight comments you make having global implications. And even more importantly, and this is the part that really makes me uncomfortable, you have to be willing to make life and death decisions about other people. You have to decide which disease gets the attention. You have to decide which country gets our assistance. You have to decide which catastrophe is considered an emergency and gets national assistance and which doesn't. And of course, there are people to help you with the decision, and you have a staff, and you're surrounded, hopefully, by brilliant, brilliant people. But ultimately, the buck stops there, right? Ultimately, the president is the person who makes all those decisions. And I think that once you're at that level, I think once you're at that point, you're so profoundly competitive, right? You're so involved in the competition that just calling it sport may even be an understatement. What they say about Barack Obama is that he is an unimaginably competitive person. Whether it's playing pool or cards or winning the election or basketball, he wants to win all of the time. And I just can't imagine getting past a certain level of political power and not having that in your DNA.
I wonder too, Jack, you hear the term selling your soul, and who sells their soul just so that they can win, just so that they can win the election. What do they have to give up? It reminds me of former Senator Heitkamp said the votes and the decisions that she is least proud of are ones that she made just to support the company line, the party line, that weren't necessarily in line with her personal beliefs, yet she had to make that judgment, right? What do I do? Do I stand up for myself or do I support the party here in this sport of politics? As we all know, the term politics is a contact sport, right?
The tragedy is actually most evident if we adjust the question just slightly and say, what happens if you sold your soul and you lost? Right. J.D. Vance, one of the accusations is, of course, he was famously opposed to Trump and he said some really horrible things about Trump. And now he is all in on Trump 100% of the time. If he wins, there's a part of me, there's a part of all of us that said, all right, he did what he needed to win. Right. Whether or not we like that or whether or not we want an uncorrupted soul in your term at the helm, there's still something in us that intuitively accepts the winner's side. Or think about Governor Burgum, who himself had tremendous criticisms against Trump and then was vying for the vice presidential spot, according to all reports. Might be vying for a cabinet position, according to at least some reports. And then if he loses, what's it going to be like to be Governor Burgum? Can he claim the moral high ground? And I think that's the answer to your question. I think that once you sell your soul, you no longer have access to the moral high ground. You can't claim to be a moral authority in a way that you would beforehand. Whether or not you like Bernie Sanders, whether or not you like AOC, you can't deny that there are people who regard them with genuine moral authority and genuine conviction that if they were to sell themselves for it, would really undermine the public image that both their supporters and their enemies have of them. And then what do you have left? And that's the ultimate soul question, right? That's the core of the religious question about your soul. Once you give up your soul, what do you have left? And the answer is you are a shell of yourself and you are condemned, whether that's for all eternity or just in the public eye.
But are you? Caveats that, you know, I was just doing the right thing for North Dakota.
Right.
Getting on the Trump train in this particular example, because I knew that would be the best for North Dakota. And now North Dakota lives on, and I'm going to still fight for North Dakota. I'm just going to find other ways to do it.
That is if we find that argument believable. If we find that argument believable, they win. If we don't find that argument believable, we don't win. And so then, again, there's that level of sort of trust, that moral conviction. What's the difference between a quarterback who works incredibly hard and makes a judgment call and misses, right? And loses the Super Bowl because of it, because they ran one play and then
an audible.
Yeah, right. What's the difference between that and the quarterback who we find betting illegally on their own game? Right?
Arch Leister.
Exactly right. Right. The quarterback who made the genuine mistake, we may be mad at them, but we will stand with them through the pain and the tragedy of losing. The quarterback that betrayed us, the quarterback that sold their soul for the money or whatever, what would it mean to find redemption in that context? And again, now we're moving from sports to religious metaphors, but the famous phrase, there's no second act in politics. What does it mean to be redeemed? And Joe Biden is the perfect example of someone who is really struggling because so many people lost faith with him after that debate. So many people were personally hurt at the prospect, even if it were untrue, at the prospect that he was hiding dementia, that all of these people were working in tandem to keep this away from him. And so many people were so personally violated in their own minds by the loss of that debate. And he gets up and he says, okay, fine, I am going to drop out. In order for us to win, in order for the country to win, depending obviously on your perspective, but in order for me to show you that I still deserve your moral approval, I am going to step down. And instantly, he became a hero. Instantly, those of his supporters were, his supporters just gushed. And even many of his opponents walked away saying, this was a noble deed. And whether I agree with him or not, this is a person whom I respect. And to watch that in real time was fascinating as a philosopher and profoundly moving as an American citizen.
It really was. I look at media, Jack, and I look at, obviously, you have Fox News, you have MSNBC, you have media that is very, very right and media that's very left. And to use the sports analogy, I look at Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark. No one in the media wants those two to be best friends. They want them to be villains and dislike one another when they compete and maybe even play dirty to win, et cetera, et cetera. And aren't we like that too in the media? We talk about these issues from one side or the other. One of the other things we spoke of earlier is, are there folks that never want us to agree on anything so that we can be divisive with one another rather than united?
I think that that's a really, really important point, because if you look at cable news before and after the 24-hour cycle, right, once CNN headline news invented the all the news all the time thing, the closest thing to political punditry was sportscasting, right, was all of these people before or after the game talking about all the plays, talking about what to anticipate. There's a wonderful book about the North Carolina-Duke rivalry called To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever.
UND and NDSU?
They do not have the vitriol that the Carolinians have because North Dakotans are two of the land, two of the earth. The Carolinians are a different issue. But anyway, to hate like this is to be happy forever. The thing about sports is there are no real consequences. The thing about sports is, unless you're a player and you get, a lot of money or a concussion or something, there are no real consequences. You can be depressed, you can go into a dark place, but in the great scheme of things, someone winning or losing,
our team winning or losing.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter unless you decide it means something to you. Politics, on the other hand, absolutely matters, and it matters on the most local level, and it matters on the most global level. And so if you lose, you are facing consequences that you yourself might find terrifying and profoundly impacting. And so that means that no matter how much we try to reduce it to sports, there's always going to be a level of impact that we can't override. But at the same time, that 24-hour network, just talking head, relentless voice, resembles nothing more to me than sportscasters trying to get people enthused, trying to talk about how the other team isn't just bad, they're evil. God is on our side, and our job is to make sure that the fans who don't understand that stay on their side of the arena. Our roads we will not cross. I can't think of the phrase, but you know what I'm saying.
Does the term sport politics undermine its importance has been our topic of discussion. We meet with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein once a month for our segment called Philosophical Currents. We're going to work on a walk-up song for Jack. We're going to continue the sports metaphor in that regard in our future discussions. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Institute for Philosophy at Public Life at the University of North Dakota. It's always so great to visit with you, Jack.
Oh, Greg, it's such a pleasure. I love this segment, and I think that you've given it new life, and I couldn't be more thrilled.
I wearing my St. Louis Cardinals shirt with my University of Wyoming banner in the background. Jack with all of his computers and tripods and other things in the back of his background that we're looking at here as we visit. Jack, it's always a pleasure. Coming after the break, our good friend Tom Ezern stops by with another one of his Plains Folk essays, and Rick Guillon talks about the great options for fall food in the region. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Living on bread.
some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
And there's the music. That must mean it's Wednesday, and it's our time to visit with Rick Guillen for another edition of Prairie Plates. Rick, I'm wondering, we had an argument in our family on whether summer was over. Labor Day is here. On the calendar, it says it isn't. I claim that Labor Day is the end of summer. What do you think? Where do you weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think it's the unofficial start of fall, and it's sure feeling like fall out there, although the weather is still pretty nice, but I tend to agree with you. In these parts, that's just kind of the way it goes.
You got to watch a bratwurst eating contest over the weekend. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I did not participate in this one, but next time I probably should, maybe for an Oktoberfest event or something. But yeah, I got to watch a bratwurst eating contest at Wurst Beer Hall in downtown Fargo last Saturday, and it was a lot of fun. Contestants had a half an hour to eat as many bratwursts as possible, and there were big tubs that they brought out of bratwursts. They all didn't get eaten, but the fellow that won, his name was AJ, and he downed 9 with the bun in 30 minutes, which was impressive, and there was another guy not too far behind. So
the question is did AJ hang around and party on through the night, or was he done?
He seemed to be done, but I stuck around for a little while just to kind of check that out, actually. And the guy just behind him, he ate 8.75 bratwursts, and he actually ordered a boot of beer. And I was,
the guy must have some chops. And yes. The thing is I have eaten there, and their brats, well, they're not small.
No, they're not. They're probably twice the size of a hot dog. So when you consider that, that's a lot of food to put down.
Well, Rick, we have a list that you have kind of put together for us of a bunch of different fall food events around the region this week. Let's walk through that to make sure our listeners know where they can go and have some fun this fall.
I went over some social media pages and some local tourism pages just to check out some interesting fall food events happening around the region, state of North Dakota, western Minnesota, and I did find a lot, but I did narrow down 8 or 9 of interest, so we'll just kind of go over those quickly today. And the first one is in your neck of the woods, Craig, Horace Bean Days, which is a big deal.
It is a big deal. Last year they had it earlier in the summer. Now they're having it when it's going to be a little bit cooler. I think that's a great move. So I'm looking forward to that. A lot of fun, a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking like street dances, car shows, vendors, you know, all sorts of things. It just is a small town community event, which a lot of people like to go to in the state of North Dakota. It's just a fun time.
What's next?
The next one is the Bismarck Food Truck Festival, and that's taking place this Friday through Sunday in downtown Bismarck at the Depot. And the organizer of this event always does a good job with it. He does food truck festivals around the state of North Dakota, and he does different contesting with Bloody Marys, bacon, Best of the Fest. He even had a corgi race at the food truck festival in Fargo a few years ago, and that was a lot of fun. So that event will definitely be worth checking out.
Corgi races. I've seen one, and they are fun.
Those short little legs, that's what.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
They can just motor.
Yeah, they can. The next event is kind of an ongoing event, but they'll be getting into fall harvest foods, which is the Red River Market every Saturday, Broadway Square, here in downtown Fargo. A lot of people are familiar with that event, so we can talk about the next one, which is Greater Moorhead Days, and that's like over a week's worth of events. And again, that's like Bean Days with a car show, a parade, vendors, all sorts of things. And so that will be a lot of fun for folks over in Moorhead on the Minnesota side of the river. And then just south of there on September 14th is a new one, this first annual Pickled Fest. And it's not what you're thinking where you go get pickled. it's actually a contest. People can bring their homemade pickles and then you will be judged on how good your homemade pickles are. And I'm guessing it's a variety of pickles, probably cucumber, beets, other vegetables, that sort of thing. But with it, there'll be a variety of vendors and some other things like that going on down in Wolverton. So that will be a lot of fun.
Rick, before we move past that, do you like pickles?
I do like pickles. I don't have a favorite pickle, but I do like them, yes.
I do like a lot of things, but Rick, I'm sorry, pickles is just not one of them, which I don't know why. Everyone else in my family loves pickles and olives, but not me. So I would be a spectator at the Pickled Fest in Wolverton, I think.
You'd have a sour face, I think. The next one on the list coming up here is a special one called Our Local Plate Farm Fest and Market. And this is north of Moorhead, and it's at Doubting Thomas Farms. And I went to this last year, and Doubting Thomas Farms, Noreen Thomas, they grow a lot of organic grains, things like that, especially oats. You can find those around. But they have vendors set up. Heart and Soul Food Truck is usually there. But the fun thing is they have local chefs that do demonstrations. Candace Stock from Burn Bombs is going to do one. And the special guest is Beth Dooley, who's a big-time cookbook author in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And she does guest cooking demonstrations on Care 11 TV down there. She's a James Beard winner, cookbook author, kind of a big deal. So I'm hoping to make that and actually interview her for this segment. So that should be a lot of fun. And then next we'll move back over to the North Dakota side and then into the Bismarck Downtowners Street Fair, which is September 13th and 14th. I've been seeing posts from the Downtowners about the food vendors already, and Animu Cucina and Fireflower Pizza. Looks like they have tents outside, and I'm guessing you'll find the cheese curds and deep fried pickles, Craig.
I'll do the cheese curds and you can have the pickle.
I'm going to have both. And then last but not least, and I think this is going to be really neat, is a hot dish festival in Williston. And this is October 12th, so a little further out there at the Old Armory. A Farmers Union is a sponsor, so it will be a good event, a lot of attendees. I judged the Fargo Hot Dish Festival this past February at Drecker, and I can tell you that was a lot of fun. If I could make it to this Williston Hot Dish Festival, it's a 7-hour drive from Fargo, but I would definitely go. It looks like a ton of fun. So, you know, good luck to those folks up there. I think that that event could become like a signature event for Williston.
We've learned a couple things since we've moved to North Dakota, and one of them is that people take their hot dish kind of seriously here.
Oh, they definitely do. The competition was fierce at Drecker this past February. So it's a lot of fun. And like I said, I think it could become like a signature event up there for them.
Rick, I want to toss in one that wasn't on your list, but my wife and I are looking forward to it. It's hosted by the Ashley Chamber of Commerce. It's the 9th annual Oktoberfest and German-Russian Day. And they claim that they will have food, fun, and frolic for all who attend. So we are looking forward to that in Ashley.
Yeah, and there are a lot of Oktoberfests around, Oktoberfest festivals and events. I'd also look for pumpkin patch events. There are a lot of those things to be kid-friendly, and I tried to stay kid-friendly with some of my events listed here too. But yeah, those are two things to definitely look out for around the region this fall.
Well, Rick, it's certainly a good time to get out and about. And I can tell you, if we have weather the rest of this fall like we had on Saturday, I will be happy. And boy, these events will even be better.
Yeah, me too. I'll be driving around checking things out. That's for sure.
Rick Yon joins us each and every Wednesday here on Main Street with Prairie Plates. Rick, thanks for coming by.
You're welcome, Craig.
More Main Street is ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, fighting fraud, promoting financial resilience, and offering local events designed with you in mind. AARP North Dakota is helping your money, health, and happiness live as long as you do. Learn more at aarp.org/nd.
Tom Ezern joins us with another Plains Folk Essay. we revisit the poignant insights of John R. Milton in his chapbook, The Loving Hawk. His verses, balancing the grim with the hopeful, beckon us to explore the depths of place, identity, and resilience through the eyes of those who've navigated the harsh landscapes of the Northern Plains.
In a previous essay, I left you in the lurch, having quoted, in closing, a discussion of the early work of the Institute for Regional Studies at North Dakota Agricultural College, now NDSU, a poem by John R. Milton. This opening poem of The Loving Hawk, a chapbook published by the Institute, ranges from the fall of man to the endless issues of place and identity fostered by open horizons. Never fear, there is salvation in the same booklet, in the form of another poem, Dust Storm, which doesn't sound optimistic, but wait, listen. Unresourced from the outer world, a light turns in, skims toward the soul of self, shines on the mind, dissects a hearted sphere of one lone man. The town is filled with lonely men, enveloped in the cloak of wind, dust driven to the inward look. Like shadows moving in the breath of God, they stumble in the dim arenas of the world. Reborn in dust, the past returns, of rain-washed streets in the afternoon. A clear-eyed look sweeps over the plains of richer gold, sky super blue. 1962 is the year of this work by Milton. This is 12 years after the founding of the Institute, which during the years 1950 to 1970, as I see it, was trying to figure out what a regional studies center should do, what the regional project should be. Milton, the poet, had been teaching at Jamestown College while completing his PhD in English at the University of Denver. The next year, he would commence what would be an exceedingly distinguished career at the University of South Dakota. But he left us this poem, which, if we decode it, will help us understand what a regional studies center should do. Unresourced, the poet begins, for there had been hard times on the northern plains, comprising, in recent memory, both the dirty 30s and the filthy 50s. Hence the poem's title, Dust Storm. Extreme hardship had its effect on people. When they most needed to turn outward, to help and be helped, they hunkered down, turned inward, stewing in their own misery. The town is filled with lonely men, says the poet, dust driven to the inward look. We know this brooding introspective habit. Often we ascribe it to Nordic and German temperament, but Milton attributes it to dust and hardship. By 1962, however, if you were alive to it, there was breathing space. Families were big. Schools were full. Gas was cheap. Cars were beautiful. Heck, towns were building swimming pools. There were rain-washed streets in the afternoon. Fields were golden. Skies were blue. Milton is telling us it is time to figure out how to live well in this prairie place. For all that holds us back is that lonely, self-centered habit of hardship. Milton was premature. There were more hard times ahead. But perhaps his poem is for us now. The regional project is unfinished. That was what the Institute for Regional Studies needed to do then, needs to do now.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and has been a longtime contributor of his Plains Folk essays to Main Street.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
Chuck Lura brings us another of his natural North Dakotas. It's fall. Chuck sees yellow almost everywhere he looks.
Are you seeing yellow? As one looks out on the North Dakota landscape this time of year, it seems that there are yellow flowers everywhere. It's the color of the season. As the prairie progresses from spring to fall, there's a progression of wildflowers coming in and going out of bloom. But when it comes to around mid to late August, yellow-colored flowers dominate the landscape. They're telling us that the harvest is on, school's about to start, and a chill in the air is coming. Perhaps the most common yellow-flowered species in bloom this time of year are the goldenrods. There are around 10 species native to North Dakota. Canada goldenrod and stiff goldenrod are two of the more commonly observed species. A quick look at the shape of the inflorescence or flower cluster is helpful in differentiating the two species. The flower clusters of Canada goldenrod are pyramidal in shape, while rigid goldenrod has flat-top flower clusters. Several species of sunflowers are also in bloom now, including the common or annual sunflower, which is often found in disturbed areas. Maximilian sunflower can be observed growing in moist prairie and similar sites. It can be distinguished by the distinctive leaves, which are 4 to 6 inches long, wavy, folded, taper at both ends, and curved downward. Maximilian sunflower is named after German Prince Maximilian of Wied, who, along with artist Karl Bodmer, explored the Upper Missouri River area in the early 1800s and spent a winter at Fort Clark. Other yellow flowers in bloom now include field sow thistle, a 2 to 3 foot tall cousin of the dandelion. It's a European weed that can be found in road ditches, abandoned fields, wet meadows, and such. Curlycup gumweed is another member of the aster family that grows to a foot or two tall. It produces lots of small yellow flowers and frequently grows on the shoulder of roads and other disturbed areas. And yes, the plant is covered with a rather sticky substance. So look for these flowers as you travel about. They're part of the floral last hurrah of the summer, so enjoy them while you can. I put links to more information on these species along with a text of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lara.
Ryan Bine is from Duluth, Minnesota, and he became hooked on Walt Whitman. His poetry today from Studio 47 is titled KFC.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Ryan Vine. Vine was born on January 24, 1977, in Duluth, Minnesota. After graduating from Denfield High School, also in Duluth, he attended the College of St. Scholastica, where he received his BA in English. It was during this time that he became, as he has said, hooked on Walt Whitman. From there, he went to Emerson College in Boston for his MFA. From an early age, Vine was influenced by hip-hop, especially groups like De La Soul and Grand Poobah Gangsta. The use of metaphor and wordplay captured his imagination. I can certainly relate to this. After all, most writers who came of age after the 1950s fall in love with the interplay of words and music. Vine's debut collection of poetry, To Keep Him Hidden, was published in 2018 by Ireland's acclaimed press, Salmon Poetry. It was a finalist for the New Issues Poetry Prize, the Crab Orchard Series, the Many Voices Project with New Rivers Press, and it was selected by Robert Pinsky for the Dorset Prize. Before publishing his first book, Vine won the Robert Watson Poetry Prize as well as a fellowship from the McKnight Foundation. He teaches at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, Minnesota. Today's poem is called KFC. I don't know about you, but I've had a number of truly awful jobs over my life. I mean, these were terrible. I've done construction, I've been a bartender, I've scrubbed toilets, and I've worked at restaurants as both a dishwasher and as a waiter. Sometimes I think everyone should work at a restaurant, especially a fast food restaurant. You learn much about yourself. This is what our poem for today talks about. It is about unrewarding work and what it does to us. This is KFC by Ryan Vine. I slice and dump vacuum-packed bags of raw chicken into a waist-high aluminum drum, a kind of barrel on its side, gut the plastic flavor pack, squeeze it in, and wash with water from the swan's neck tap whatever's left of both bags, then splash that in there too. I shut the hatch, spin the squeaky drum, chant 1, 3, 5 bingo bango bongo 15 times, and slap the side when it's done. Kyle's propped the receiving door open. He's smoking. The snowy wind blows the smoke back in. After I spun the drum and the seasoning has become inextricable from chicken skin, I give it one last rotation, aim the hatch at the wheels, roll the catching cart into position, and pull the sticky ringed pin. Imagine disemboweling an aluminum pony, all the raw, wet noises unraveling. Cold air slides across the floor like a cast spell, and Kyle's stopped even trying to blow his smoke out the door. I'm only 16, but when I drop the pieces of dead bird into the batter box, I understand it's not much bigger than the boxes these poor birds lived their short lives in. Still, I coat the slippery chicken in just enough flavored dust, pick 10 pieces for a meal, toss them into a rectangular wire basket the size of a bread pan, and lower it into one of the four dirty fryers that Kyle was supposed to clean. They lean against the wall behind us, smoking like they're on break. In the middle of what becomes my last shift, I slam a bottle of Robitussin, and within minutes, I can't even stand. I push my foot through the floor and watch it in the basement knock the white buckets around, down where we keep the huge American flags, washed and folded. "You should go," Kyle says, "but I don't want to." Even as he bows by the back door and I'm sucked into the street, even out here where everything is sparkling snow, and not the falling kind, but the finer stuff the wind pulls from empty parking lots or apartment rooftops, I don't feel like leaving. I'm not bothered by the boulder my mind's become rolling down the hills I'm trying to climb.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 4th. On July 15th, 1864, Captain James Fisk led 97 wagons out of Fort Ridgely, Minnesota, bound for the gold fields of Montana. Fisk planned to avoid the most dangerous territory by following a shorter, unmapped, and untried route. Unfortunately, he failed to consider the increased hostility on the part of indigenous tribes in the wake of the U.S.-Dakota War. He was confident as the wagon train left Fort Rice. He thought a large force of soldiers under General Sully was traveling ahead of him. But 80 miles west of Fort Rice, Fisk learned that Sully veered north, and the expedition was now protected by the small number of soldiers with the train. Then the worst happened, when the wagon train came under attack. Fisk instructed the people to circle the wagons and to fashion a breastwork out of sod. They called their encampment Fort Dilts, named for one of the soldiers killed in the initial attack. While a small party rode to get help, the besieged wagon train was able to hold off further attacks for 2 weeks until a rescue party arrived from Fort Rice. The would-be miners had had enough. They returned to Fort Rice and from there went back to their homes, having never seen the gold fields of Montana. Fort Dilts was added to the list of North Dakota state parks in 1931. The original site was just over 8 acres, with plans to add another 6. State Representative Matt Crowley made plans to transfer several acres of his own land to the state. In preparation for completing the project, archaeological investigations yielded many valuable artifacts. Russell Reed, the superintendent of the State Historical Society, noted that some trouble has been experienced in preventing relic hunters from mutilating the old Indian village sites associated with the area. Originally planned for August, the Fort Dilts site was finally dedicated as a North Dakota state park, on this date, in 1932. It became the 30th park in the state system. A time capsule containing documents about Fort Dilts was placed into the base of a monument constructed of petrified wood. Prominent state and local officials spoke at the event. Today you can still see the wagon ruts, the remains of sod walls, and graves. The fort, constructed out of sod in desperation, looks much like it did those many years ago. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with clinical psychologist Dr. Helen McKibben. She's the author of Drop,
making great decisions. She'll talk about kids going to college and their parents. What is it about helicopter parents? We'll learn a lot about that tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope that you can join us.